From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, writer Zach Brook talks about the philosophy that guides Reggie Moore and the Office of Violence Prevention that he heads.
It's kind of like if you build up the fabric of the community, people are less prone to violent outbursts.
Plus, this Sunday celebrates two groups of important pollinators, bees and migratory birds.
Following the death of an influential French chef, Paul Bartolotta reflects on why the French have such an outsized role in food.
The language of music is Italian, allegro and adagio. You know, the language of food is cuisine. It is mousse and souffle and julienne and all the culinary terms because they codified it. They created the language of food.
And comedy writer, Milwaukee native, and Marquette grad Jeannie Gaffigan reflects on a lifetime of humor ahead of her commencement speech at Marquette this weekend.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. After some notably violent years, the homicide rate in Milwaukee has declined a bit over the last 2 years. And while there are a complex set of factors that play into that dynamic, the city has made a concerted effort to develop a strategy to curb the cycle of violence.
One key player has been the head of the city's Office of Violence Prevention. Reggie Moore has been on the job for a couple of years. He's been featured in stories and segments on WUWM, but he's also the subject of a profile in the May issue of Milwaukee Magazine. Writer Zach Brook joins us by phone to share his reporting. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
What did you find most intriguing about Reggie Moore?
Reggie is just indefatigable. This is a man who works just, 60-hour weeks. He is 7 days a week for that office. He is just always on. 60 hours might be lowballing it. He might be insulted if he heard that. But this is a guy who does event after event, and does house calls, and is just so selfless. I asked him if he had any shortcomings or any, like, the job interview question, like what would you say is something you need to work on about yourself? And he was like, work-life balance. I put too much into this job, and it's hard for me to step away when I need to step away, which is something his wife, Charlene, also would agree with.
You write that he actually he's been doing community activism since he was a pretty small kid.
Yeah, he caught the bug at a very early age. He was about 10 years old. He was in a public housing facility in Hillside neighborhood, and it was the 80s, and the crack epidemic had come to Milwaukee at this point, and he saw it as a 10-year-old, not being able to understand what it was. All he could understand was, all of a sudden, he couldn't go in the playground anymore. It was too dangerous. So he decided, 10-year-old Reggie Moore, that he was going to go door to door and organize a block party so that everybody could come out and he could have the playground back with his friends, because he'd be supervised. The adults would say that it was safe enough to go out there again. And he went to the apartment manager and she said, if you get people on board, I will do this. And he did. And ever since then, he caught the bug. And he's been in activism pretty much his whole life.
And, you know, so that's kind of how Milwaukee shaped him. He went away from Milwaukee for a while as well. How did that period in his life shape the guy he became?
He went to Washington, D.C. for a while. He was actually working with an anti-tobacco nonprofit. It was there where he first was introduced to, public health strategies and concepts to dealing with some of these problems. I mean, he works with violence now, which is a lot different than smoking cessation, but it was there that he sort of ran into how public health strategies can be employed to improve, the health of a community.
Well, so what sense do you get for why Milwaukee leaders saw him as kind of the ideal guy to head the Office of Violence Prevention?
Well, I think if you look to when he was appointed 2 years ago, Milwaukee was coming off a really bad year in terms of violence and homicide. Mayor Barrett and others saw in him a community leader, an outsider. He wasn't a career politician. He was wasn't somebody that worked in government. They saw an outsider that actually had buy-in from a lot of the communities that were most hard hit by this violence. He had a successful track record of progress in establishing nonprofits. He had been, at that point, the leader of Urban Underground for a number of years, which he had founded. Like we said earlier, he was in Washington, D.C. with the anti-tobacco group. He had worked for Public Allies for a while. He knew people. He knew how to get things done. And, you know, the Office of Violence Prevention was in pretty rough shape. And they looked to him as somebody who could kind of approach, like step in and on day one have support from the partner organizations that the office would need to be successful.
He also took a page from the playbook that organization in Chicago, which I guess is now called Cure Violence. It was then called Ceasefire, what they were doing. Can you kind of describe what the approach there was?
Yeah, this is the whole novel approach to dealing with violence. And it's looking at it like a public health issue instead of just a criminal justice issue. That doesn't mean that, you know, crimes go unpunished or anything. Reggie would be the first to say that anytime something bad happens, that there's a crime, that person needs to be dealt with or we don't have a safe society. But rather than looking at cleaning up the mess after the crime is committed, they are interested in seeing what can be done to prevent the crime from ever taking place in the first place. And a lot of that deals with interrupters. That's what Cure Violence did in Chicago. They employed people. A lot of them were former offenders. They employed people to walk around these hotspot communities with high levels of violence and just kind of get to know people and get a sense of when there might be some sort of violent incident brewing and intervene, interrupt, and sort of calm everybody's heads. I mean, it sounds simple, but if you look at the statistics, like, it's actually really, really effective. And that's what Reggie has tried to bring here. He, of course, is trying to get Ceasefire, but he's also done things like host block parties, which show decreased levels of violence for a couple weeks after they're thrown. It's kind of like, if you build up the fabric of the community, people are less prone to violent outbursts.
Well, so how was his work in Sherman Park, say, in the wake of the Sylvia Smith shooting, emblematic of what Reggie Moore is all about?
Yeah, Sherman Park was Reggie's first big test. He was still relatively new to the job. He was in Chicago, or coming back from it, when the shooting took place, and he actually lives close by, and so first thing he did was he drove over there. He likes to say that he was there from the first brick. It would just started to turn violent when he got there. What he means by that, the first brick that was thrown at a cop car and broke the window. He and his staff, to their credit, were there for the whole 48 hours that stuff was going down. He would try to intermediate. Sometimes there would be men that were making demands of the police, and the police wouldn't be responding because the police had work to do, and the men would be getting angrier and angrier. And it was up to Reggie to kind of play go-between, like, okay, what's your question? I will get an answer for you. And he did it. There's another time the police had detained somebody or taken into custody this man whose girlfriend was actually going into labor. So Reggie, when he heard about this, asked the police if he had done anything that had merited charges that he needed to go to jail for. And when the police said no, he was like, look, this guy's girlfriend's about to have a baby. He should be there. Can I take him? And the police said, if you take him, if you transport him to the hospital, you can take him. So he just kind of played that good Samaritan, you know, professional good Samaritan, because he's the leader of the office, and that's kind of his job.
Well, so he's been in this office now for a couple of years. Homicides have decreased slightly in that time, but are there bigger ways of quantifying the impact the office has had?
The statistics have shown a slight uptick. Reggie will be the first to say he can't take credit for it. He'd also be the first to say it's not enough. And
you say uptick. You mean downtick, I guess, right?
I do mean downtick. I do mean they've declined slightly. But yeah, he'd be the first to say they're not enough. And you know, critics agree. Critics and supporters agree. I think he is heading into a stage, and it's yet to be seen whether or not it'll be successful. But he's heading into a stage where he will pursue the most aggressive violence prevention strategies that
the office has seen. Certainly under his tenure, he spent most of his time since Sherman Park developing something called the Blueprint for Peace, which is a document that secures buy-in from so many different stakeholders and outlines a plan to actually reduce violence in the long term for Milwaukee.
You're right, though, that there are some who think this kind of approach is not fast enough.
Yeah. One of his leading critics is Alderman Borkowski. He supports, Reggie as an individual, but his criticism is that the plan doesn't go far enough and it doesn't go fast enough. Borkowski would like to see any resources that we would give to violence prevention instead go to law enforcement. We need law and order. His constituents are suffering, and he thinks that, more police will be the solution to that. So that's the criticism, that if every dollar we spend on public health prevention is a dollar we could have been spending on law enforcement, and how do you stop the crime faster is the debate that the two of them are having.
Well, right. So what's Reggie Moore's take on the speed with which change can happen?
I would say that Reggie would advocate that the best, cheapest, and most lasting way to reduce violence in the city is to invest in violence prevention rather than, violence cleanup or criminal justice after the fact. Because, even if you catch all the people that commit crimes, violent crimes, or what have you, that trauma has been inflicted, whether or not those people are prosecuted and go to jail for long periods of time. And that creates fallout in and of itself. Like all those victims, have lives that are impacted and could manifest themselves in other negative ways. If you look at the fabric of the community, every dollar you're spending on police, you're not spending in the neighborhoods in ways that could help people that would be inclined to violence or inclined to self-harm, prevent that and maybe put themselves on the right path.
Zach Brooks, it's an interesting read. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Zach Brooks' article on Office of Violence Prevention head Reggie Moore is in the May issue of Milwaukee Magazine.
We'll take a short break and then look ahead to some celebrations this weekend of creatures large and small. That's when Lake Effect returns on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
More of Lake Effect now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. This Sunday holds special significance for people concerned about creatures large and small. May 20th is both World Migratory Bird Day and the first World Bee Day.
WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz has the buzz on the Western Great Lakes Bird and Bat Observatory, which tracks migratory birds and builds awareness about the importance of conserving their habitats.
Bentz met with the group's president, Bill Miller, at one of the observatory's key monitoring spots, Harrington Beach State Park. It's located along Lake Michigan between Port Washington and Sheboygan.
We're going to walk around the edge of a clearing that's surrounded by woodland and look and listen for whatever migratory birds might be here today. So you can hear a red-bellied woodpecker and a singing American goldfinch and a singing Tennessee warbler. So in the middle of May, it's kind of peak time for a lot of migrating passerines or songbirds.
Bill Miller says the focus of the Western Great Lakes Bird and Bat Observatory's migration monitoring focuses on waterfowl.
All of the birds that are associated with Lake Michigan.
But songbirds get counted too, when they're seen or heard.
Because he's on the shoreline, many land birds pass his position too. So his task is to stay at that single location 6 hours a day, 6 days a week throughout the spring and fall, and count all the migratory birds that pass. And again, in a typical season, it's fall seasons have numbered by the end of the season about 180,000 individuals of about 170 to 180 species. This last fall, he set a new seasonal record with over 200,000 individuals. Again, in that period between September 1st and early December.
And the spring cycle?
The spring runs from March 1st to May 20th. So those are the, you know, March 1st, you're starting to see a lot of those early species of waterfowl.
On our path to meet Calvin Brennan, the waterfowl technician, Miller muses on the plight of bird species on the Wisconsin landscape. He says about a third are stable. A little less than a third are increasing.
Peregrine falcon, bald eagle, wild turkey, trumpeter swan. But then there's another 35 to possibly even 40% of our bird species that are in decline for a wide range of reasons. So the effect of huge storms, you know, that's probably been acting on bird populations since there have been birds. And then there are diseases. But now human beings have altered the environment tremendously.
Invasive species like quagga and zebra mussels have altered Lake Michigan's ecosystem and what's available for migrating waterfowl. Miller says climate change is evident in plant leaves opening and insects emerging earlier, which could be an issue for migratory songbirds who stop off in Wisconsin to rest and rejuvenate on their long journey.
And so there's this mismatch between the phenology of plants changing and the fairly constant arrival of some species. But we see that birds are responding in some ways because some species are migrating earlier and migrating later in the autumn. And that's probably related to climate change for those species where that's occurring. Waterfowl, for example. Some diving ducks show up here at this latitude, you know, central coast of Ozaukee County, later in the autumn than they once did. And it isn't just a couple of days, it's a couple of weeks later. And in a few minutes, we'll visit our technician who counts them. So he's got to multitask. He's got to identify the birds and then count them. And it's pretty straightforward to count when there's 1, 2, 3. But then when there's 50 or 100 or 1,000 or 5,000, becomes much more complicated. Now we're coming to the end of that important spring migratory period for some of those water birds, but some are still moving, so we'll see what he's finding today.
Calvin Brennan stands eyes riveted on Lake Michigan. His season has almost ended, but he's here with binoculars in hand and a special scope and multiple counters to double-check his numbers.
So how's it going this morning?
It's all right. I'm pretty steady, not real super busy, but mostly common terns. They probably have, 1,200 common terns. Which sounds busy, but it's been more steady than than busy.
And although the tern is called common, Bill Miller says the species is endangered in Wisconsin.
So using the word common to describe it is really kind of silly. And yet a lot of the terns that pass through here go well north of Wisconsin to breed. There's actually only very, very small numbers of common terns breeding in Wisconsin.
You have the sense that each of these men, one quiet, the other less so, care intensely about each bird that comes along. Calvin Brennan says simply,
you have the interest and then you start doing them and it gets sort of contagious or whatever. And it's sort of an acquired skill too. A lot of birders wouldn't spend 6 hours a day standing out here looking over the water. They want to be on the move. They figure the best bird is somewhere else usually. So they don't have the patience to do that. So in that way, it's sort of an acquired skill.
Brennan will help out on World Migratory Bird Day and then head home to Central Michigan. September 1st, he'll be back on duty at Harrington Beach State Park. Bill Miller says the data Brennan amasses, combined with the work of monitors and researchers throughout the Midwest, is the only way to come up with effective conservation. For Lake Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
Bill Miller is president of Western Great Lakes Bird and Bat Observatory, which will host a celebration of World Migratory Bird Day this Sunday. He spoke with Susan Bentz, and there's more information about the event at WUWM.com.
Another break now, and then a conversation about the legacy of a French chef and how it influences a Milwaukee restaurateur. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. One of the luminaries of French cuisine died early this year. Paul Bocuse is credited with basically introducing American diners to French cuisine and then demystifying it. He also launched or mentored the careers of many American chefs, including Milwaukee's own Paul Bartolotta.
Bartolotta and food historian Kyle Cherik joined Lake Effect's Bonnie North in the studio to talk about Bocuse's legacy and why he was so important.
He had a discipline and a love of the craft. He called it le métier, the mestiere for the Italians, but the métier in French, and the love of the profession. You know, so often we look at people who work in restaurant businesses as, you know, this group of people who just sort of found a job in the restaurant and they ended up staying there. These were chefs in France who really changed food around the globe because he was the first true celebrity chef. You know, there were other famous chefs that made an impact on the evolution of French food. And when we talk about music, for example, the language of music is Italian, allegro and adagio. You know, the language of food is cuisine. It is mousse and souffle and julienne and all the culinary terms because they codified it. They created the language of food. Bocuse is the latest in this great run of four chefs, three prior to him, that really made a difference in developing French cuisine, but I think had an impact globally.
So some of the chefs before him, Escoffier?
Prior to Escoffier, you would have Carême, Antoine Carême. Mm-hmm. And then you had Auguste Escoffier. And then you had Fernand Point at La Pyramide in Vienne. And then as a young apprentice in those kitchens, you had guys like Bocuse and Toigrot and Alain Chappelle. And, you know, these guys who went on to define today's modern French cooking. And they all played a role in that evolution. Carême was probably the one who created haute cuisine as a like restaurant kind of food.
Yeah, grand cuisine was the term that they gave him for all the sauces and the everything. I mean, this is a kid that was abandoned in the streets, orphaned in the streets during the French Revolution, went on to be the most accomplished and famous chef of Napoleon's First Empire and cooked for Rothschilds and Russian royalty. So he was really the guy that everybody wanted to be like and died at 48. I mean, you think about Bocuse at 91 and what he accomplished, but, you know, cut that life in half. It's really incredible. So that's the standard, as Paul's talking about, this line starts with.
And then and then Escoffier, was the person who really codified French cuisine. He's the one who basically wrote sort of the brigade system, you know, who was the saucier and who was the entremetier and who did each one of their jobs in the kitchen. So his job was that. And then he also codified it by standardizing many of the recipes that we know of today are all classics from Escoffier's book, for sure. You can have hollandaise sauce in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Melbourne, Australia, or Paris, France, and it will be hollandaise sauce.
Right. Well, and his book is over 1,000 recipes. I mean, it's not just for haute cuisine and fine cooking, though it definitely is, but we have it on our shelf, and we'll flip to it. It's pretty much that and Julia Child, and there's spots where you just, our kids laugh because with Julia Child, if you set the book down, it's either going to fall open to quiche or crepes. And with Escoffier, it's going to fall open to sauces or to roasts. And it's like, we still use them every day.
So, you know, you're talking about a very French thing, French food, French way of doing things, as you say, standardized. It has bled into all kinds of other cooking, though, hasn't it? These standards?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I'm Italian-American, born here in Milwaukee, moved to Italy, was in love with Italy. My whole goal was to elevate the stature of Italian food. And then I was at this one of the restaurants that was this two-star Michelin restaurant, and I was the chef de cuisine. And I felt like I kind of had peaked at that restaurant.
Which
and I
is
wanted
a term
more.
From Escoffier, by the way, chef de cuisine. Yeah.
Right, chef de cuisine. Yeah. And then Escoffier term, right? The chef, the actual cooking chef, the one who runs the kitchen day to day. And it was a two-star Michelin restaurant. And they were members of some very important food guides like the Relais Chateau and Tradition and Carité. And so they literally took me to France because they knew that I was in love with regional Italian cooking, but they felt it would be a miss if they could assist me in having an experience working in
these grand restaurants in France. And I went there deliberately not with a notebook to say I'm going to sit and write down recipes, but I came to absorb the professionalism, the mentality, the work ethic, the discipline, the precision. But I really compartmentalized my brain to say if I'm cooking French food, I'm going to think like a French person. But my soul, my heart is in Italy, and yet, so when I think about food, I really got to sort of turn off that brain, the French side of my brain. But I will say that there is certain techniques and disciplines and organizational structure that I learned in France that have proven to be invaluable, and that's translated to the way we organize our kitchens in our restaurants here in Milwaukee.
It's so interesting to me, and I don't know that this is true, but it's sort of my sense of it is that Italian cooking, and I'm talking fine Italian cooking, not necessarily just home cooking, seems to be looser, kind of like the music is. It's like there's a lot more room for improvisation, and French cooking is much more precise and maybe even a little fussy. And I wonder if that's true. Is that a fair thing to even kind of compare them that way?
Well, you're looking at me. I'm looking at you. I mean, I'll take it, but no. I'm going to be
Well, I'll give you an example. I'll give you a couple of examples. So I mentioned Hollandaise sauce, right? Well, the beauty and the tragedy of Italy is that you can walk down the main street of Bologna called Via Indipendenza. It's the independence road in the center of Bologna. And there are, on both sides of the street, there's probably 20 restaurants on each side all the way up. And all of them make tortellini. And every one of those restaurants make the best, most authentic tortellini. And yet not two of them are the same. So while that is part of the individuality that is uniquely Italian, and I love that spirit of it, it's a head scratcher when you try to define anything that's Italian, because a lot of it has to do with what your personal tastes are. Do you like lots of mortadella in your tortellini? Do you like a lot of sausage? Do you like more prosciutto? Do you make it with only prosciutto? So it's like, you know, it's a head scratcher. Hollandaise in Melbourne, Australia, Paris, France, or Milwaukee, Wisconsin will be Hollandaise. Full stop. Now, the French also had a point in their evolution, partly under Bocuse and guys like Roger Verger and Michel Gérard and these other guys. They were chefs who saw the need for an evolution, hence the movement Nouvelle Cuisine, which happened in the 70s and 80s. And I was working in France at that sort of pinnacle moment. So I was, by happenstance, by luck, I happened to be living in Italy when Italy was having a food and wine evolution revolution. And the same in France. So I kind of got a little taste of both the modern influence and the really staunch traditionalists in both of those countries.
Well, and I assume that serves you well here, both of those
influences. It kind of worked out.
Well, it does. I think what serves me well is that I have really, really amazingly talented chefs in the kitchens that allow me to play in the kitchens rather than sort of toil in them every single day. And in each one of our restaurants, we have chefs that have been with my brother and I for a very long time. And, you know, they do a lot of the heavy lifting. But I think that we have given them sort of the direction that we believe each of our concepts should go. We don't want to limit the personal creativity of our chefs. But there is a certain sort of organizational structure that we've set up in our restaurants so that they run that way. But it's really about our chefs.
I think Paul's being a little humble because he's one of only two chefs in the history of the James Beard to win it twice and other things. But he's precious for me, one, through the friendship, but two, because of his connection to people like Paul Bocuse. I mean, you know, I just had an idea, and we'll bounce them back and forth, and I texted him shortly after the great chef died, and he texted me back, I'm with the family, and then a list of basically every chef that's still living that I would like to meet, all in one room, and they were there to honor the great chef. And then basically, well, Bocuse had planned his funeral, so they were there to step in line and essentially say, we chef, even though it's posthumously, right? Yeah, and do as he had prescribed. But Paul trained and cooked with Bocuse, and he's got these great intimate stories about him lending a jacket or so on and so forth, where taking him through the market. And these are treasures. As a culinary historian, you don't get firsthand history. I can't talk to someone that worked with Escoffier. They're all gone, or Carême, or Lapointe, or so forth. I can talk to a chef that will tell me intimate stories about what it was like to be trained by someone that influenced pretty much everything on a Western plate right now.
So was he approachable?
It was. There's a big sign up on the wall in the kitchen. It said, silence en cuisine, silence in the kitchen. And it was crazy because in his kitchen, nobody talked. It was complete silence, except when he came in. And he would joke around and kid around with everybody. And I have to say, I love the world that we're in. I love being a chef. Paul Bocuse started some 30 years ago a sort of culinary Olympics in his name in his hometown of Lyon. And it's called the Bocuse d'Or, meaning the golden Bocuse statue. And they have three statues every year, gold, silver, bronze, just like in the Olympics. And it's sort of the Culinary Olympics. And I sit on as a culinary council member for Bocuse d'Or, which was founded by Thomas Keller, Jérôme Bocuse, his son, and Daniel Boulou. And they were charged by Mr. Paul to make sure that America got the representation. Paul Bocuse was injured in the resistance, when he was in the resistance in the war, and he was taken to an American field hospital where he was given a blood transfusion, which saved his life. And from that day on, outside of Auberge, there's always two flags flying, the American flag and the French flag. And he will always say, there's American blood in my veins. I love America, and I do everything for America. He was the first chef to come over to America to open at Epcot in the 80s, when that was looked at, oh, cooking at Epcot, what a sellout. You know, you're a three-star Michelin restaurant. And he said, no, you don't understand. America is ready for the next level. So in a way, you know, he was the Folgers precursor to Starbucks. Like, he understood at that moment to do that kind of food, which Americans were just getting prepared to. Mm-hmm. He didn't do the food that he cooked in Lyon, because at Epcot it probably wouldn't have been appropriate. But he was the flag bearer of his country, but he was also... he saw the potential of America maybe in food before we saw it in ourselves.
And every chef that I've interviewed through the show and things like that made pilgrimages, sometimes kind of quietly, to Epcot to eat Paul and Jerome, his son's food. Yeah. Because this was like, you go and kiss the ring. I mean, I live in America. I don't have to get on a plane. I'm an idiot. Why wouldn't I go there? Because they've been cooking this great food. And then they'd go back in the kitchen and talk and so on and so forth. But, you know, when I first learned of this, I'm like, you went where? I'm like, oh, I'm the idiot, actually. Okay. Yeah. Some of the best French food in the country was happening in Epcot.
You know, we're talking about the effect that Monsieur Paul had on the world, and also how he had an effect on restaurants here because of you. Going forward, what do you think his legacy is going to be in the kitchens of Milwaukee?
Well, I think it's just beginning. And what was interesting was, with all the modern information for the internet and such, a lot of the young kids, sadly, didn't know as much about these people as they probably should. You know, I'm very pro the free-spirited chef who, you know, is a little bit the alchemist in the morning and comes in and looks around and grabs some stuff and starts whipping some, and every day it's a new dish. And I appreciate that. End of it. Our philosophy in our restaurants is a little bit different, in that we think that the consumer today, more than ever, really wants to know as an educator. So there may be consumers out there who are interested in this alchemy, but there are also consumers who want to be taken on a journey. And the journey isn't just sort of the chef's craziness of the moment, but it's also dishes that have a storyline.
So I have to ask, is there a favorite Paul Bocuse dish that you would go back to? And Kyle, I'm going to ask you the same thing, but Paul Bertolotto, what do you think?
There are probably a couple of them,
okay.
And probably because they're the ones that I made. So we're doing his classic soup de truffe that he made for the president of France in 1975, and it's been a signature of his restaurant ever since. So the soup de truffe, for sure. The sole Fendant Point, obviously, another one. And then there was one in the early 2001, 2002, they were doing an event for Meals on Wheels in Rockefeller Center, New York, called La Crème de la Crème. And it was invited the top six or seven major French chefs. And each of us were given a chef that we were going to cook the food from. And Verger was there, and Bocuse was there. And so I was given Bocuse. And so I immediately made this dish, which is the loup en croûte. It's the sea bass, the Mediterranean sea bass, loup de mer. And it's stuffed with lobster and black truffle, and it's cooked in puff pastry. And I did it because I knew it would be a big challenge for me personally, but I knew that if Mr. Paul came over to my booth that evening, that I wanted something that to show him that I not only did I learn this in your kitchen, but I got it. I got it. I could do it. And of course, he came over with Danielle to see my booth, and Danielle dragged him over, and he's like, oh, Luan Crute, and he's like, you know, there's like mille personnes, you know, it's like 1,000 people here. He said, are you nuts? And I said, no. I said, I've got timers on each tray of whatever, and I showed him the whole system so that I didn't overcook the fish. And he said, okay, well, I said, let me taste, you know, and I made it for him, and he was really gracious, and he made me feel really good that we did something that honored the experience having worked for him. So probably Luan Crute, that would be my dish.
Okay, and you got it.
I like to think I did. Yeah. He made me feel good.
And Kyle, for you?
I would say I can't pronounce it correctly, but it is that chicken in the pig's bladder, because from a historical context, I love dishes that you can trace through. I mean, Paul's got this incredible raviolo dish that goes back to cooking for royalty and Italian royalty, and his mentor taught him how to do it, and he only makes it on special occasions. And the first time that I really ever ate his cooking, he made it, and he pulled me aside, and he said, this, like, forget everything else is happening, pay attention to this. And it changed my evening. And for Bocuse, it's, you know, so Carême was the first one to work in molecular gastronomy. We didn't call it that. He used pig bladders and he put it into what now we call sous vide, only then it was just hot water, but he kept it very low and bring the temp up and things like that. And now chefs are doing it in plastic bags and so on and so forth. But Bocuse, of course, knew that, and it had transferred through his mentors, and he improved the dish or the technique to this depth of flavor that is just sort of like you never had a chicken that tastes so good. You could never have a chicken that tastes so good. You should never even try to have a chicken that tastes so good. But it's that sort of historic where I can eat something and I get a thrill, where I can see the line going back through history and further beyond, and that gives me goosebumps, and then it tastes so good.
On top
time.
Of it,
well,
yeah.
We opted not to do it in the pig's bladder because I just didn't think we were quite ready for running around the dining room with pig's bladder. These
yeah, that's fair.
Spheres
it's
running
fair.
Around. I mean, that has a certain cachet in France. I looked at Adam and he goes, Paul, I can't do that. I just, he said, love to do it, but I don't think I can do that. And I said, I understand. He goes, but I'll make the same Morel cream sauce and I'll do a beautiful roast chicken and I'll marinate it the way we marinated for the poulet. So it's an adaptation and adaptation of that dish that he's doing. And again, the Morel cream sauce is just, you know, it's not spa cuisine. I warn you now, but but it's just so unctuous and so full of flavor and so delicious and so moist.
Not everything has to be spa cuisine. You know, everything does.
It's okay to eat for pleasure and
absolutely.
Eat food that's rich and delicious. Yeah, you can get on the treadmill and you can live a healthy life, but I don't think we need to forego pleasure all the time.
Bocuse never did.
No. And he was 91.
Yeah.
And may we all live as well and as long. Well, Paul Bartolotta and Kyle Cherik, it has been such a pleasure. And now I'm starving. So we better go out and have lunch, but I want to thank you both so much for coming in.
Thank you. Thanks
for having me. Thanks for taking on such an interesting subject, because he's a remarkable man.
Paul Bartolotta is a Milwaukee chef and restaurateur behind restaurants that include Bacchus, Lake Park Bistro, and Ristorante Bartolotta. Kyle Cherik is a writer, host of Public Television's Wisconsin Foodie, and a regular Lake Effect contributor. They spoke with Bonnie North.
One last break now, and then we chat with Jeannie Gaffigan. The comedy writer and Milwaukee native will team up with her husband, comedian Jim Gaffigan, to give the commencement address at Marquette University this weekend. You're listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM Now. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. When Jeannie Gaffigan takes the stage at Marquette University's commencement this Sunday, it'll almost feel like a victory lap. Gaffigan graduated from Marquette back when she was Jeannie Noth. She's been a comedy writer for years since then.
But the commencement speech, which she'll make with her husband, comedian Jim Gaffigan, is also a return to the stage following surgery to remove a life-threatening brain tumor last year. Jeannie, who grew up in Milwaukee, and Jim Gaffigan collaborate on much of Jim's stand-up material, but she was solo when we caught up with her via Skype from New York. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you for having me.
Can you talk about what humor was like around the Noth household for you growing up in these parts?
I think that it was just like a basic element of survival, just like eating or sleeping. I think that when you have a full house, you need to survive with wit, because it's easy to get lost in the shuffle. So we all developed kind of this, creative way of communicating with each other. And also my mom and dad are really funny. Like, my mom has more of a over-the-top sense of humor, and my dad is very dry and subtle. So all of us have a little bit of a combo of it.
Well, and did volume have to play into it as well when you had that many people around?
It definitely did. Volume was a big part of the performance of our conversations.
I ask partly because I'm just interested, but also because you have a large household now, and I'm wondering whether the vibe around the Gaffigan home today, at least when you're all in one place, compares to what it was like growing up in the Noth household in the 80s.
It does kind of compare, but you have to remember the Noth household was double the size of the Gaffigan household. So I have no idea how we all actually even made it through grade school, because I'm always like calling my mom going, "Mom, how did none of us die?" Because it's, you know, it's a constant battle to be like, don't do that. Don't run in the street. Don't, you know, there's a lot of don'ts. And there's a lot of kids. So, but at the same time, we do have a very lively household. And, you know, I think my husband, who's basically the youngest of six, I'm the oldest of nine. So I guess that oldest youngest thing is kind of a thing. Birth order, like I'm kind of a caretaker and he's kind of like to get care taken of. So I think that he thinks that I sort of have this perpetual need to recreate the chaos of my childhood by taking on way too much work and having too many kids and all this stuff, but he's kind of enjoying the ride. So I think that we kind of learned survival, and we learned how to get through things, you know, with humor. And I'm a big, you know, fan of big families.
Well, you know, your current big family forms a significant part of yours and Jim's humor. But what strikes me about it as I listen to it is it's in general terms. You don't seem to, or Jim does not seem to expose any one of your children directly in terms of the humor, which I would imagine is intentional. You're using them, but you're not using them.
I mean, I think that it's there. I will say that we do point out, you know, my 8-year-old or my 9-year-old, you know, we do individual shout outs here and again. But as you know, everyone passes through these kind of similar phases, and with such different personalities, we have different behavior associated with each kid. So, but there are a lot of similarities with like 5-year-old behavior in general. So, it's kind of more of an observation that is timeless, that kind of live in time for even, you know, someone who remembers their kid being 5 or has a 5-year-old or had a 5-year-old or will have a 5-year-old, just kind of to keep everything universal. And we kind of, our humor is observational. So it's usually what is right in front of us. So obviously, when Jim and I didn't have any kids, we didn't write about kids. When I didn't have a brain tumor, we didn't write about brain tumors, you know. And it's just sort of like, we just sort of, our comedy is kind of the lens with which we look at life.
It's interesting. I was thinking about, you know, comedy at some level, and for some people, really shapes how we see the world, right?
Absolutely. It shapes how we see the world, and it shapes like how we process, you know, how the world sees us.
I mean, yeah, I my aforementioned son, who turns 10 tomorrow, is really one part fourth grader and one part Jim Gaffigan quote machine. But as I watch him get older, it's really interesting to see how he has gone from, you know, Bonus Fry and Hot Pocket references to his own material. But that material is really informed by the funny people he watches and listens to.
That's very flattering. And that's good, because you want to have a positive influence. You don't want to be like, you know, my son started smoking crack because he saw Jim Gaffigan do it. So I'm happy to hear that.
So you and Jim are giving this commencement address at Marquette as a team, which is something that you did a few years ago, I think, at Catholic University.
That's right.
First of all, how did that address go?
And that was one of the best experiences of my life. I mean, it's such a unique experience to be able to stand up in front of a group of people who have just achieved this fantastic milestone in their lives, and their loved ones around them, you know, everyone's looking up at this stage, and it's just this really overwhelming feeling of like love and gratitude that makes, you know, what I do in my life just so much better. And I'm very grateful for the experience.
And at some level, you have to go into it thinking that, you know, you are there as part of what is one of, to that point, one of the most important experiences in these kids' lives.
It's such an honor, and I'm so grateful for it.
Well, so when you think about what a commencement speech does and what it has to do with comedy, do you see, is there kind of a Venn diagram overlap in terms of, you know, helping shape how someone looks at the world from that point on?
Well, you know, I mean, I think that, and that really comes out with how lucky we are to be part of a team, because doing a team commencement speech is really a fun experience. And what it also does is that, talk about the Venn diagram, is that that crossover, that middle part that has heart and humor, is, I think, probably easier to achieve with two people doing it, because you know, I don't want to like, you know, take anything away from our Catholic youth speech, but when, you know, there's a lot of stuff that you want to impart, like a lot of what a commencement speech is being like, okay, I went through this already, and this is how I see the world, and this is what's helped me in my life, and this is what I want to impart to you. And then there's also the fact that it is really early in the morning, everybody wants to go to their party, and you don't want to bore them. So that's where the humor comes in. It's like every commencement speech that is a good commencement speech has elements of entertainment in it. And so you're also entertaining people while you're conveying this, you know, important pearl of wisdom, hopefully, that that is important for people to hear, and that that you've been honored to be asked to give them. So you want to honor that, but you also want to entertain people and make it, you know, a fun experience that everyone can kind of interact with and understand.
It was nice that the Pearl of Wisdom alarm went off as you said that.
Oh, good. That's a built-in alarm that I like to have around.
Well, and not to give away any spoilers from the speech, but you and your family with you have gone through a lot since the last time you got up on stage to give a commencement speech. You mentioned the brain tumor that you went through, and this has to play into how you see, first of all, how you see the world from here on out, and also the kinds of things that you can, the lessons that you can impart to graduating college students.
Absolutely. It doesn't, you know, there's that's kind of a funny observation too, because hopefully not a lot of the graduates are going to ever have to go through anything like that, but it really does inform it. And it completely transformed my life. And it, you know, it wasn't like I was like a degenerate, like drug addict or something before. And now I'm like, oh, I'm, you know, I see the light, but it really did shape my perspective in everything. And I think that without having had that experience, it would be really great to have. And, you know, I also say Jim had the experience too, because he's my partner and we went through it together. So, you know, I'm writing a book right now, and I'm recalling seeing the people waiting to go into surgery in the waiting room, and the, you know, many, many, many people that were about to have surgeries at Mount Sinai Hospital that day. And it was very difficult because it was pre-check-in. So no one was like in a hospital gown. So it was very difficult to know which person was having the surgery and which person was the caregiver, because both of them looked like they were about to go through something really traumatic. So that said, when I say what I went through, I mean what we went through, Jim and I went through, and our whole family went through. It's because we went through it. And I think that on the other side, especially with the success of the surgery and the pretty much miraculous recovery that I am enjoying right now, it's just going to shape the way that, you know, I see everything and that Jim sees everything and what we would want to impart onto the graduates. And not that Marquette should be bragging that they're going to get a better speech than Catholic U did, but they kind of are. Because even though I feel like our message at Catholic U was really profound and fun and funny, and the theme of it was about working together. It was almost like, I would say, a premonition of what was about to happen. It was like a kind of a foreshadowing, because we talked about how right now everyone is kind of at that point where, I mean, the very few people have their life partner when they're, you know, graduating college. But so most people are like, this is me against the world. I'm going out there with my diploma. And that speech was really geared towards, look at the people around you who love you. You couldn't have been here without them. You couldn't have been here without your professors. And Jim and I could not have done what we've done in our lives without each other. So it's other people and relationships that are really the things that are going to carry you through your life. You can't do everything alone. No one is Superman, right? So ironically, that's what carried us through the biggest challenge of our life, which we hadn't even known that we were about to face. So coming out on the other side, we have a new perspective and a new message for the Marquette graduates.
Well, and in a way, it sounds like, you know, without even realizing it, you were kind of laying the groundwork for being able to get through that really hard period by doing that speech, you know, a couple of years before.
Yeah, or just, yeah, it really, really was the type of thing where, in retrospect, you go, wow, it was about being together and about relationships and about carrying each other through the most difficult times in life. And then, lo and behold, you know, like months later, we are faced with something that we needed each other for. And we came out victorious. And I'm so grateful for that. I'm grateful for Jim and my family to have helped, you know, carry me through that really devastating illness.
I think a lot of people that you've never even met are grateful.
Thank you very much.
Jeannie Gaffigan, first of all, let me say continued good health. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today. And as the book comes together, I hope you can repeat what your brother did and come visit us in the studio.
It's a date.
Jeannie and Jim Gaffigan will deliver the commencement address at Marquette University this weekend. Jeannie grew up in Milwaukee and graduated from Marquette. She's also the sister of New Yorker cartoonist Paul Noth, who we spoke to last month about his middle grade novel. You can find a link to that interview at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Joy and I produce the show along with Bonnie North, Audrey Nowakowski, and Maddie Andre. We get additional support from our departing intern. Claudia Delgadillo has done some amazing work over the spring semester, and I am sure this is not the last time we will say her name on the radio.
We get additional reporting from Susan Bentz and studio engineering from Jason Reavy. Michelle Maternowski is managing editor, and Willie Porter wrote our theme music.
Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock, and Fresh Air is next.